Hi, welcome to Holden Village. This is June 1996. Our speaker today is Tom Perry. His subject, Indians of the Chelan area. Let's listen in.
First off, I have to say that I am not an expert on the local Native population. And as Kimmy suggested, I do have the book, however. Actually, up until, well, I guess nominally last year, not much had ever been written about the Meethows, and that's the way they pronounced it apparently, the Meethows, the Entiats, the Chelans, and the Wenatchees as distinct groups. If you look them up in the indexes or in the lists of languages and so forth, they're all lumped in with the Columbia Salish. The Columbias were another group that were east of the Columbia River. And so tonight what I want to do is kind of go over some of the things I found out about the early days of the local First Nations population. And there are some really interesting stories that have come out of this. And John has taken the information on this book, which I found at the Chelan Ranger Station in their little literature section. And I think he's getting some for the bookstore. So sometime there should be some copies of this. I don't think the library has one yet. It's a new book. The people of this area, or this immediate area all around Lake Chelan, were all Salish people. Salish people are distributed all over the Northwest, along the coast, and up through the interior here. In fact, we're getting pretty much for the interior as far south as they get in this part of the woods. In our vicinity, there are two main branches of Salish. If you go up to the Okanagan River, you get the southernmost bunch of what's called the Northern Interior Salish. I happen to work in British Columbia with some members of this group that are further north. They go a good 500 miles up north from here. The Shuswap are the northernmost. There's the Thompson group around the Thompson River. There are the Okanagans, which span the border. In fact, there's still a group of Northern Interior Salish called the Bonaparte Band. And that name comes from Bonaparte Creek, which flows into the Okanagan River near Tenasket. So they're all up and down that part. Now, when you get down onto the Columbia, you have what is called Middle Columbia Salish. And that comprises the group that includes the Columbias on the east side, the Meethows, the Entiats, the Wenatchees, and the Chelans on this side. So those are the main groups we're talking about. They all got here, of course, by the main route of migration across from Siberia at least 15,000 years ago, maybe longer. I mean, about 15,000 years was probably the last opportunity to make it across. They probably came down the plateau between the Rockies and the Cascades. The way that the coastal Salish people got where they are is they went down rivers. And so you'll find that the rivers are very much what define their culture. This is true here, and it's true on the coast. And the other thing about Salish people is you'll find them where there are salmon. They were salmon people. It was probably a long time ago that the inland and the coastal people separated, but they still had a lot of contact because they both would move up and down the river corridors. I've given you a little bit about the classification of them. The groups that you run into to the further east and to the south are no longer Salish. You have, particularly to the east, a lot of what belong to the Sahaptin group, the Nez Perces, the Sahaptins, further south, the Umatillas, and so forth. So this is kind of the eastern and, to some extent, the southern range of the interior Salish. Now, as I said, there are salmon people. They like to locate where there are salmon runs. There's a band that located on the Entiat River, which had salmon in it, but you don't find any in Railroad Creek. There were no settlements in here because there were no salmon. That's just about the size of it. Very likely the Chelans hunted in this valley, and the Entiats as well, because they did come up lake and into the valleys to do their hunting. And so the long discussion over hunting we had over the winter probably has a very venerable source that goes back centuries. The other thing about fisheries is you may have seen pictures of the way that the Salish people fished. And you didn't go out on the bank of the Columbia somewhere and just decide to fish that way, because they used spears and they used weirs, and they were not hook and line people. They also used nets, but they were these kind of, you know, catch them as they jump nets. So they needed a particular kind of place to do that. And so there were two extremely important places to fish in this region. All of the people of the rivers fished at these places, and as far as I know, there were never any wars over these places. One place was near Leavenworth in the Wenatchee River. They called it the Wenatchee Fisheries. It was on the Wenatchee and on the Chihuahua River. And these are typically narrow, rocky places which have lots of places to stand or to build the spearing platforms out over the river. The other place, which no longer can be seen, is Celilo Falls, which has been submerged by the Dalles Dam down along the Columbia as it turns out towards the sea. That was the really big place. There, apparently hundreds of fishermen could work at one time at that place, because of course the Columbia is much larger. They lived in the Chelan area around the Chelan area, Wapato Point, Manson, and all those areas, in permanent villages that were typical of the interior Salish, half subterranean houses dug down at least 3 feet, which incidentally is quite an architectural feat for a culture that does not use shovels. I'm not quite sure how they dug, but I think it involved picks and baskets. It had a sloping timber roof with a long smoke hole. The buildings could be as long as 50 feet long, so they have a long slit along the ridgepole. And they would be covered with tule mats or any kind of thing they could get hold of. Later on, even, they started using canvas. As the villages that you find on Lake Chelan, and there are quite a number of them. There was one, for example, it was only a summer village. It wasn't one of these permanent ones with these lodges. There was one at 25 Mile Creek. There was one at Lake Chelan State Park. There were a number between the river, the Chelan River, and Manson on that shore. That was kind of the preferred shore, the far end on the north side, so that there were quite a number of villages in Lake Chelan, and also for the Chelans down on the Columbia around the Chelan Falls area, where the Chelan River goes into the Columbia. The Entiats occupied the lower end of the Entiat River and up and down the Columbia. In fact, within 2 or 3 miles of the most downstream Chelan village. The Wenatchees, on the other hand, were really clustered in the lower part of the Wenatchee River Valley and on Wenatchee Flats, which is where the city is now located. Wenatchee Flats, because of its topography, was well known as a council place for meetings. It was a place where they had their horse races. It was the place where the first trading post in the area went up. And it was where a lot of government and native meetings took place. Now, even though they were Salish people, the locals had a lot of Plains Indian influences. For example, for summer shelters, they used teepees. They got horses in the 1730s. And under one of the big Columbia chiefs, there were huge parties that actually moved into Montana for the buffalo hunt as soon as they got horses. So they began to use buffalo like the Plains Indians. They got into some wars with the Blackfoot over that. They didn't take kindly to folks from Washington deciding to come and take a few of their buffalo.
Can you explain what you mean by they got horses?
Apparently they traded for them because they had originally been brought by the Spanish further south, and they began to breed and trade, and they just by process of intertribal trade, they got up this way. They were not introduced by white people here. They were sort of passed along. And in fact, that was taken up by some of the local natives, particularly the Antiats, became horse breeders and drove big herds of horses for sale, even across to the coast. That was later on when there was more white settlement here, but horses spread throughout the West, and it took a little longer to get up this far north, but they got here. The Plains peoples had them for quite a while, apparently, because they had been hunting buffalo from them for some time. The method of hunting buffalo before that, of course, was to stampede them and chase them off a cliff or something. And there is a park where this was done in Alberta called Head Smashed In Buffalo Jump. And there are literally yards and yards of bones deep at the base of a cliff you can go see. Well, eventually, of course, white contact had to come, and it was the Lewis and Clark expedition that first contacted any of the local peoples. The meat house, it turns out, were somewhere down around the Walla Walla River for some reason when the Lewis and Clark expedition came through, and so they got into Lewis and Clark's journal. You know, we met this group called the meat house. And that's the first recorded contact with any of these groups. Probably they were down there in the fall to go fishing down at Celilo Falls. They were still there in the spring when they came back, though, and that's the interesting part. And so they got them in both directions in the spring of 1806 as well. In 1811, a Canadian by the name, well, he was British then, right? By the name of David Thompson, after whom the Thompson River further north is named, came down the Columbia and contacted all of our local native groups, the Chelans, the Antiats, the Wenatchees as well, and wrote about them in his journal. And then in 1811 as well, Fort Okanagan was built on the present town site of Okanagan, the town. That was not a military fort so much as it was a fur trading post. So the fur trade came to this area around 1811. Well, I'm going to go start describing some of the things that the historical events that shaped what we have now in terms of settlements and so forth. And for that, we need kind of a list of players. There were some big important chiefs that made a lot of decisions and entered into a lot of treaties during the 19th century that really had an effect on what happened around Lake Chelan. At one point, it very nearly was put aside permanently as a reserve. And so there wouldn't have been a town of Chelan, at least not one populated by white folks. And so a lot of the story that there is to tell about this is about land and settling and some of the disputes and treaties that arise out of that. The first is the line of Entiat chiefs. Now, the Entiat chiefs, it seemed quite important in terms of a lot of the things that went on, even though they weren't big warriors. They weren't sort of the top leaders, but they had a lot to do with the way Chelan in particular developed. There was a record of a chief by the name of Silcohasket, who, well, the chief names in these tribes stayed the same. The appointed son who was to be a chief took the same name. So they put Roman numerals after them. At least we know about the first one. He died in 1790. He died above Stehekin in the mountains in the winter on a goat hunt in an avalanche. Much of his hunting party was injured or killed. A lot of them got away, and that's the reason we know anything about him at all, because they told the story. His son had the same name, was the entitled chief of the Entiats. After that, it was his half-brother, however, who it turned out had more to do with the development of this area than he did. And his name was Wapato John, or Nkwilakin, who he wasn't a great political leader, but he was very important to the Entiats in that he was their big merchant and diplomat. And so later on, when all the negotiations went on, he seemed to always be there. So Nkwilakin, or Wapato John, I think he was born in 1825, died again in 1911. So he was important during that critical period of the 19th century when all of these things were happening, all of these things happened. The Chelans were a rather small group, but they had one very well-known, well-connected, and cantankerous leader named Nyunamositsa, which means Rainbow Robe. One of the Chelan villages was named that. And he had two sons, Nyunamositsa and Nyunamositsa. So one of them called himself Nyunamositsa Bill and Nyunamositsa Jim. So, and eventually he called himself Long Jim. He anglicized his name. But Nyunamositsa lived until 1884, so he was there for most of the important events of the late 1880s, but he died right when everything was sort of settling down, and he did not see how things turned out, and he probably wouldn't have liked to have seen what happened. Then the Columbias, there was one chief who really established the Columbias as a big tribe. He led the early buffalo hunts and so forth in the 18th and very early 19th century, Soltalskosum. But his son was far more important. His name was Quetelitsin, otherwise known as Moses. Now, Chief Moses, and there are so many things named after him over there, Moses Cooley, which isn't too far over here, on this side, this is where Moses had his seat. And so this was the headquarters of the Columbias, and they were all through this territory. That was their territory, and they were a big, big important group as far as many of the native groups around here thought, and as far as the government eventually thought. So Moses was a critical player in all of this. And to make matters more complicated, and turned out to be a very important diplomatic issue, was Moses was Chief Joseph's cousin. Chief Joseph, of course, was the chief of the Nez Perce, who was involved in the Nez Perce Wars, and Moses played this to the hilt with the government. He was a very coy old rascal. You know, well, you know, I've got my cousin over there. I really ought to be helping him, and what do you do for me? So those are the players. And what develops in the latter half of the 19th century. The thing that sort of starts everything off is the fixing of the Canadian border, what is now the Canadian border, the 49th parallel. That happened in history students?
Oh, man.
1846. right? We almost were in Canada here, right? And likewise, part of BC was, or most of BC was almost in the US, but that, where they cut it off was the 49th parallel. Then only 2 years later, the Oregon Territory was created. That meant there was all this sort of miscellaneous land up here, and it only took five more years, 1853, to create the Washington Territory. And that brought in Isaac Stevens, who was the first territorial governor, and at the same time was the commissioner for the railroad survey. He was governor and appeared to be on the payroll of the Northern Pacific Railroad as well.
Can't get away with that today.
And if you put two and two together, you know, the trains go through Stevens Pass, don't they?
Yes.
The other person that came in at the same time was the first military leader in the area by the name of Captain George McClellan. Later, of course, General George McClellan of Civil War fame. And his job initially was to be in charge of the railroad survey. Now, Stevens was a very expansionist governor. He wanted to make room for settlers. He wanted railroads, settlers. He wanted to really move quickly. He was also very hostile. He got in a lot of quarrels with the military over the dealing with the native people, because his theory was, you attack them first, and then you have a peace talk. But the military had orders from Washington to do things differently, so at least they didn't do that. The next thing that really happened that got things moving in terms of, if you want to call it, relations, they were not good initially between the native people and white settlers, was the gold strikes in the Colville area northeast of here, and further north in the Fraser River area in Canada. This brought hordes of gold miners from California, who had just about played out what they had done down there, all the way up through the Central Plateau on their way to Canada or to Colville. And this is the first thing that really got the natives upset. They didn't like waking up in the morning and finding a bunch of miners camped in their front yards. Worse yet, they didn't like to go fishing and find a bunch of miners hanging around their fishing grounds, possibly poking in the gravel and everything else. And so they were collectively quite upset. They didn't like the idea of outsiders traveling through what they considered their territory. The miners, on the other hand, complained to the government, writing letters and everything, that the Indians were not hospitable. The miners, it turns out in this whole story, are the agitators. They constantly agitate over things that the government does. And many times, given the situation, the government's interest and the government's intentions were actually in the right place, but the local people in their letter-writing campaigns, their agitation, and in some cases their vigilante behavior, kind of ruin things. I said some of the time. The rest of the time, the government was not a particularly good player. Now, to make matters worse, one segment of the miners that came up through here were Chinese. They had been railroad workers. They were brought into this country as railroad workers, but as soon as they could get away, they went off to mine, because they could make more money as a miner than working on the railroad. They could also live as a miner. I mean, apparently the work on the railroads were just was gruesome. By 1870, there were 300 Chinese miners in the Wenatchee Valley, and they considerably outnumbered white settlers. By 1879, there were 500 to 700 of them on the Middle Columbia. There was a Chinese store across the river from Chelan Falls. So they were a considerable presence here. And unfortunately, one of the chiefs from further north, I think it was an Okanagan chief, was the first one to make contact with Chinese miners. His scouts brought in two of them. He called an immediate council, and they consulted for two or three days over what to do. They determined these people are not white people, and they're not Native people. And at that point, Medicine Man got up and made a speech and concluded, well, then they must be devils. And from then on, Native and Chinese relations were just terrible. And of all of the groups in these valleys, turns out the Chelans were the ones that liked the Chinese miners the least. And in fact, in 1875, on one of the benches overlooking the river outside of Chelan, the Chelans massacred 300 Chinese miners. They had actually gone upriver and up the Mekong to look for them, but somehow they had gotten word in advance, and so they all got out of there. And they finally found them again, hiding up on one of these benches. And they surrounded them and did them in. That didn't stop the flow of Chinese miners. By 1881, there were several hundred back in the area. They never would go up on that bench, though, any of them. It became kind of a superstitious thing about going up there. And then in 1883, they began to decline because the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1883 made it impossible for more Chinese people to come into the U.S. People were tired of having that immigration, and the miners were the principal among them because they found out that they were having to compete with a great number of Chinese miners for the available claims. There were missionaries too, of course. Religiously, the Salish people in this area they have what they call a dream religion. Their medicine man would have visions. There was one in this region named Smohalla who was considered to be very powerful because he predicted the weather. He was also known to have an almanac. But he got lucky one day. He predicted the big earthquake of 1872. And after that, everybody listened to him. That's the one that created the mess down at Earthquake Point. It was quite a scene. The rock in that cliff tumbled into the river. The river was dammed up for about 24 hours. The Wenatchees sent scouts up the river to try and see what was going on because the river was drying up. It finally, after 24 hours, broke loose and started flowing again. But it's interesting, Wapato John, this Entiat chief that I mentioned, lived right near there, down on the Columbia. His house was flooded. His sod roof caved in. His family had to sleep outside in the light snow that night, so that it was quite a scary thing for everybody there. And so Smohalla, the medicine man, was quite revered after that because he knew all this was coming. So this dream religion then was what the missionaries first found when they came. They also found polygamy. This turned out to be one of the big obstacles, because every time they would go into a village and start talking to the chief, and the chief would find out he would have to send all but one of his wives away, they wouldn't hear any more of it. Nonetheless, there was a mission established near Kashmir called the St. Francis Xavier Mission. It had branches in Chelan and most of the other areas. In 1873, by a Father Grassi, an Italian priest, who was not received well at first. Inamosiche, the cantankerous chief of the Chelan, sent him away. He came back the next spring speaking the Chelan dialect. Inamosiche was quite impressed. He made some headway. He actually converted him. But then he was moved. Father Grassi was moved, and a new priest came in. And the Chelan said, well, that's over with, because the chief's personal relationship with that priest was sort of the whole story. Other native groups were not quite that way. Wapato John actually became quite a devout Catholic, assisted in the Mass, had all of his relatives baptized, and continued to be a pillar of the church around Chelan and the Entiat. The old Entiat chief, Sukil Hohaskat, rejected conversion. Unfortunately for him, though, his several wives didn't. And they kind of chose up sides, and one of them stayed with him and the rest left. And he was quite upset about that and wouldn't speak to the priests after that, obviously. Well, I think that probably the activity that really caused the biggest upheavals in this area, both with the settlers and with the native people, were the whole process of reservations and treaties. So I'm going to go through some of the things that happened, and you'll begin to understand exactly what went on in this country when the government got involved. In a sense, it's the kind of story we're used to hearing about, you know, there goes the government messing things up again. Because you had the military on the one hand, you had the territorial government on the other hand, you had the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and you had the president. The president personally was involved with some of these things because they involved treaties. And so requests for treaties would go to Washington, and the answer would come back from the president himself. Things started off after, as you remember, the miners came in and there was unrest among the local natives because they had all these miners traipsing through their country. So the government decided to do something about it. In 1855, they called the Big Council at Walla Walla. All of the big chiefs from up here went down there. Tekalitsin of the Wenatchees was there. Lahome representing the Intiats, that's Wapato John's father-in-law. You notice there are a lot of marriage relationships here. A lot of alliances were formed by intermarriage. And so cousins and in-laws and so forth are very important for the way the structure in this society worked. Most of the tribes in this area signed the Walla Walla Agreement. It was worked out over several days. It was very tough. The chief of the Yakimas, Kamayakin, who was a well-known warrior, was holding out and holding out to the last. Finally, the government came in, the military came in and said, if you don't sign, we're just going to go over to the Yakima settlements and annihilate them. So basically, he signed at gunpoint. The Chelans, however, and this is important, the Chelans didn't sign. They never did sign a treaty. Yanomasitsa didn't believe in them. He wouldn't have any part of it. This also was the treaty that makes everyone think this is Yakima country, because it's the treaty that created the Yakima Reservation. It also set aside that little area around Leavenworth, which was the fisheries on the Wenatchee River. The Celilo Falls was part of the Yakima Reservation, and they had their other fisheries here. The locals were happy with that. We've still got our fisheries we can migrate to every fall and catch the salmon. However, the treaty didn't even last a year. It didn't stop the incursions of all the miners. So the natives were angry. They got up a big, they had a lot of skirmishes with miners. And it turned into what they called the Yakima War when the cavalry got involved. There was a big battle at Toppenish in southern Washington. The cavalry lost. By the next spring, however, May, the cavalry had succeeded in defeating the allied tribes. And Yanomasitsa certainly was among those who rode with the native groups. The skirmishes with miners went on for a couple more years. In one instance, in 1858, Yanomasitsa tried to trick a bunch of miners, 150 of them, into a box canyon up towards Fort Okanagan where they could be ambushed. However, they found out about it, and all but six of them got away. So this kind of thing went on all through the 1850s. Then came the Civil War, and not much happened. It's because the government paid no attention to what was going on out here, and everything sort of went on the way it used to be. A lot of the miners evaporated during the Civil War, and so it was kind of quiet. The next thing that happens, though, is the Colville Reservation is created. Now we're looking at a big chunk of land up here. It was for the St. Pauls, the Nispalums, the Colvilles, which are not Salish people. But it's the first really big chunk of traditional land that's set aside for a native group. And it really was in response to, again, calls for opening up this country for settlement and for more miners. And that was one of the first steps. The next thing that happened, though, was that the government decided to try to move all the Columbias, including the ones on this side of the river, to the Yakima Reservation, down south, right in this area. All these people down to here where the Yakimas are. This was the time, however, of the Nez Perce War, so 1875, 1877. Chief Joseph is giving the cavalry fits over there in Idaho, eastern Oregon, edges of eastern Washington. So this is when Moses was playing his game. What he did was, instead of, you know, answering promptly the government's interest in dealing with him, he called all of the local groups together to build war villages. And they had amassed all of their warriors in this area, mostly out in the Columbia River where they're easy to see. And he kept sending messages to the government, "Don't worry, I'm for peace. I will keep my braves under control. I just have them out in these villages where I can keep an eye on them." And so he was playing the agitated younger chiefs on the one hand and saying, "Oh well, he's letting us set up war camps." And he's also playing off on the other side the government. He really consolidated his power. He was seen as sort of the preeminent chief among all the Middle Columbia peoples. And he was seen by the government as an engine you can deal with. So the government called them all together and asked them all to move to the Yakima Reservation, and they all said, "Sure, we'll go there." And then they all went home and did nothing. And it was just their little trick on the government. He knew that the government was so concerned about the Nez Perces that they were not really concerned about them, and they wouldn't come and try to enforce it. So he continued his kind of game, and in 1878 another war erupted, the Bannock-Paiute War, further down to the southeast. So the cavalry was even busier. And Moses continued telling the government, "Well, I'm for peace, you know, and I'm your best hope for peace in this region." Then he told them, he says, "I really want my own reservation, you know." And he sent them a proposal, which essentially covered all of this country and this side of the Columbia. So he just decided he'd try to take all of the traditional Columbia lands and make a reservation out of it. But then, in 1878, the militia came out to try and force Moses to go to the Yakima Reservation. Well, he had the war party all waiting in Moses Coulee, and they actually did a big charge in full war paint and everything and stopped 100 yards short of the militia. And Moses sent his cousin, Yunimosichtsa, of the Chelans. This was his big day. This was the only thing that the historians ever wrote down that he said. Sent him riding out to deliver the ultimatum. He said, "Me interpreter, Chief Moses wants to talk to you." Moses say, "You go back over the river and mind your own business." And you know what? They did. At that point, Moses was looked on as the really big chief in this area because he chased the military off. By the September of that year, 78, the government had too many military problems and they wanted to deal with Moses. So they called a council down at Priest Rapids, which is where that PR is noted there. They came upriver in a steamboat, anchored it there, and they had a big council with Moses. And this time, Moses, instead of taking his warrior chiefs, he took Wapato John. By this time, Wapato John had a trading post on the Columbia, the beginnings of a ranch. He had already done things like introduced apples to the Columbia Valley. His name, by the way, Wapato, means potato in Chinook. He brought potato farming with him. And he was well respected among all the white settlers as a merchant. And so it was a big signal that he brought Wapato John instead of Yinamositza, who is that rascal who causes all the trouble. So they had a powwow there where Moses outlined his request for a reservation, and this time it was even bigger. It went all the way down. And included, and it went over here and included some of their root digging country because they like to dig roots, the camas root and bitterroot. So there were some mountains over here that they wanted to include. They wanted a little more of this part too. And so the General Howard, who was negotiating for the government, looked at it and considered Moses a reasonable guy. Thought this is a reasonable request, and he sent it to Washington. But the only thing wrong with his proposal was it left out those Leavenworth fishing grounds that were so important to all those folks there. And this particularly bothered the Wenatchees. So he didn't really have the Chelans and the Wenatchees fully on side for this, but never mind. The proposal went to Washington, went to the government, went to the president's desk, actually. Meanwhile, the settlers in the South were getting really agitated because there had been raiding parties going through murdering settlers down around in the Yakima country. And for some reason, people got it in their head. The rumor was going that Moses was behind it. And so there were vigilante groups that wanted to go get him. The militia wanted to go out and try and get him. And by December, the military actually came out and they arrested Moses and his cousin Yinamositza. So the chief of the Chelans, the chief of the Columbias, was actually arrested for these murders. While he was in prison at Fort Simcoe, down on the Yakima River, he got the message back from Washington. The president rejected his proposal for a reservation. Well, he was very disappointed. The good news, though, was that he was invited to go to Washington to talk about it. So this pumped him up again. And by that time, by late winter, they had figured out that there was a band of renegade Umatillas who were doing the raiding. And so they let the two chiefs go. And Moses got to go to Washington and meet the, I guess it had been the Secretary of Interior then. In Washington, he got a proposal promptly from the government to create a new reservation west of the Colville Reservation. It would go from the Canadian border up here, down along here, along Lake Chelan, and include the Entiat, the Wenatchees in the mouths anyway, and would essentially take in much of this territory that was traditionally the west side of the river peoples. So he thought this was a pretty good deal and he accepted it on the spot. This was 1879. Well, the Wenatchees were still cheesed because it didn't take in this place near Leavenworth, which was their traditional fishing grounds. And that was very important to them, because as the Wenatchees, they were sort of the arbiters of this common fishing ground, and that gave them status and wealth. The Chelans, as you might imagine, were just elated, because this is their country. And the idea of it being set aside forever was quite appealing to them, and Yinemesitza was beside himself. He was so happy. It was only 5 years before he died. He was an old man there. They called it the Columbia Reservation, but the general who negotiated it liked to call it the Moses Reservation, which made Moses no. They had a big powwow. The government was there, the provincial or the territorial governor. And the government then moved to create Camp Chelan, which was a military post on the town site of where Chelan is now, in 1879. So military people were brought up there and they were stationed there. This was going to be government headquarters of the new reservation. Well, all of the settlers in this region thought this was great. This was going to solve the whole problem of all the dissatisfied natives, because they all seemed happy with it. But further north up by the Canadian border, there were lots of miners again. And when they heard about it, they were furious. They started agitating again, writing letters, complaining to the military constantly. And so weakness started to come into this whole plan. The general immediately stopped all settlement in this whole area, pending the approval of the new reservation proposal. It still had to be approved by the government. In 1880, because of budget cutbacks, Camp Chelan was closed. So the military presence here, which kind of stabilized things, went away. And then some strange things started happening. In 1881, the Entiats, a lot of whom did not live within the bounds of the new reservation, because it only got a corner of their territory, were forcibly moved into it. This meant that many of the Entiat people moved from the Entiat River here up to the north shore of Lake Chelan. In fact, Wapato John moved to Wapato Point. And that's where it got its name. A lot of people refer to the Wapatos as an Indian tribe. They're not. It's a family name of Wapato John. And later on, in the early 20th century, they turned the name around, and so they were called Peter Wapato and David Wapato, and so they took it as a last name. So all of a sudden, all these Entiats were up here, except for old Shilshohasket, who was close to 100 already anyway. He was born in 1788. He lived to 1900. He died when he was 112. And he basically said, "I'm not moving anywhere for anybody." And he effectively, single-handedly, prevented people from settling any further up the Entiat Valley, because he didn't like settlers. And they got the proverbial seat full of buckshot if they came past his house. The locals, now that's sort of new people. The local settlers that he knew, apparently he was quite friendly with, would dance the old dances for them and so forth. But anybody who wanted to push further up his valley, they were out of luck. And he just stayed there, and the government figured, well, he's so old anyway, it doesn't matter. So things started to fall apart as far as the administration of this goes. The Wenatchees were all cheesed about this, so they refused to go. So we're not going up that reservation. We belong on the Wenatchee River. This is our place. We're going to stay here. They'd always been pretty peaceable natives, so the military backed off and didn't bother them. They were citing the 1855 treaty, which gave them their fishing grounds on the Wenatchee River, and so it looked like a legal model to them, so they left the Wenatchees alone. But then, in 1883, because of all the agitation up here along the Canadian border, the government decided, well, let's give 50 miles south of the Canadian border, this strip along there in the reservation, give it back to the miners. They're mostly up there anyway. So So the natives were a little perturbed that they were starting to take pieces out of what they thought was a pretty good reservation. But then sort of, I would say the ultimate trick came in 1883 when Moses suddenly got invited back to Washington. And this time he wasn't invited with all these folks over here who were in the reservation, but he was invited to bring along the Okanagans, including Chief Tenasket, the old divide and conquer routine. And the government this time made a new proposal. Now, this is this business of who speaks for whom, right? As far as Washington was concerned, it's Moses who speaks for everybody. But in the chief system of the Salish people, it's not one person that speaks. It's a council of chiefs, and there's sort of the chief among the chiefs. And every time the government called a meeting, it seemed like it was a different bunch of chiefs. So a number of those people didn't recognize what was going on. What the government did was basically offer Moses money to go to the Colville Reservation. Instead of settling down here or over here, settle up here, east of the Okanagan River and inside of where the Columbia turns north into Canada. They offered him a pension of $1,000 a year plus a bunch of money up front. And essentially he sold out the Antiats, the Chelans, and the Wenatchees on that spot. The Okanagan saw it was a great deal. They got something too. And so that's what happened. And so the government dropped this whole idea of this reservation. Well, I guess you'd say the Chelans were a little perturbed, because the next thing that happened, the government said, you have two choices. You can either take allotments, and that's for each family, a 640-acre allotment, or you can go to the Colville Reservation, take your pick, and the military is here to enforce it. The Chelan said, we're not going to have any of it. We don't want it. We'll be like the Wenatchees. We'll just not make a treaty at all. So they didn't. Itamosichi was 1 year away from dying. He was an old man, and he just refused to take any of this, and that was the story. Meanwhile, you'll remember, all the Entiats had moved up here. Well, they got this offer too. They waited a respectable few months, and then they filed for all the land on the north shore of Lake Chelan. Wapato Point, all Manson, all that area turned out to be Entiat, although that was traditional Chelan territory. So they got the choice real estate. And in fact, Wapato John's son, Peter, died in 1949, a quite wealthy man. He did a lot of the development in that area and around the town of Manson. So that was the choice, and if you didn't take any of this stuff, the only thing open to you now was homesteading like all the white settlers, because although it had been closed to natives up until about that time, they changed the rules and allowed the natives to homestead. So that was their only choice. Itamosichi died in 1884, and what was left, I guess, was sort of the normal story of settlement. At that point, in 1886, the area was open for white settlement. The first white settlers came in. They were William Sanders and a Henry Dumpke. And they came in from the Methow Valley with a pack train, and their prize horse on the pass through into Lake Chelan fell over a cliff. And they named the creek down there after him. Want to guess what his horse's name was?
Prince.
So they came on in. They settled along the shore there in various places for a while. Dumpke eventually went across the lake and built a sawmill by a waterfall. And that's how Dumpke Falls got its name. He didn't last long. The sawmill didn't last very long because it was only 2 years later that Lewis Wooden came to Chelan and built a real big sawmill and set up a lumber camp or a logging camp at Stehekin. And they floated the logs down for their sawmill. So he couldn't compete with that big steam-powered sawmill in Chelan. Another settler, early settler, was Ignatius Navarre and his family. He was a civil engineer who did the survey. And he happened to name a coulee after himself while he was doing it. The Chelans were still not, they were left essentially by this whole process as dispossessed people. They had no place to stay, that they could homestead, but they didn't want to do that. Long Jim, who was Yenomasitsa's son, then decided, all right, they'd give us all this baffle gab, I'll get myself a lawyer and I'll go to court. And so he did. And he established that the allotments that were originally given to the treaty signing groups were still valid. And so a decision by the land commissioner in Washington, in fact, nullified a lot of homesteads around this area because they were still on land that traditionally belonged to the native people. And so until they decided where they wanted their allotments, they couldn't homestead. So Long Jim took the part of the Chelan town that is now the city park and around there. And he promptly built himself a horse race track and a rodeo grounds. Gambling was always part of the native culture. Horse racing in particular was a favorite thing. And that horse racing track then attracted people from miles around. It was a very popular thing. And Long Jim actually did pretty well in Chelan after that, after he took his mile square allotment. That was in 1892. And after that, it's pretty much a story of how the town of Chelan develops. But for years after that, every summer you could still see lots of teepees out on Wapato Point. That's what they did. They had their summer residences right down on the water. And some of the pictures from the 20s and 30s are quite interesting because you see all these teepees lined up there with a Model A Ford parked by each one. All in all, though, it's a fairly typical story of Native people in the West. It's a trail of broken treaties, a lot of ending up being dispossessed, a lot of cases where the Native people didn't understand what was being done. And they also felt, the Chelans and the Wenatchees in particular argued with the government later on after they found out what Moses had done in terms of dealing for them and said, we are not Moses Indians. We are unto ourselves. We have nothing to do with that guy. And so it caused a lot of unrest, not unrest, but bad feeling among them. And it was said that towards the end of his life, Yenomasitsa saw Moses one more time and refused to shake his hand. He was so angry with him. It's just about 8:30, so it's a little past actually, so I'm going to stop there. If you have any comments, we can take a couple minutes of it. Yeah.
Where are the Chelan today?
They pretty much evaporated. Long Jim was the last Chelan chief. There are descendants of the Antiats who are still fairly prominent in Chelan, the Evans family. Bill Evans is one name that comes to mind. They're descendants of Wapato John. They're still around. Their investments were all in that area, and it's in real estate, and they stayed in the area. Yeah.
I stopped off and saw that kind of a casino over there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not on a reservation then.
No, it's not a reservation. It's on what's called allotment land, which is, it's not exactly, it can be sold under certain conditions, but most of those are on leases from the people who got that land under allotment. Much of that is leased land.
So Native American leased land?
Yes. The Native Americans own it, but they were restrained from selling it freely. And so they lease it.
probably doing better as a result.
Over the long term, yeah. Because there's a long history with the land office of very unscrupulous dealings with the natives on price for land.
Yeah. And historically, the Eastern Sioux, for instance, lost it because they got drinking habits and would drink it away.
Yeah.
They just couldn't, you know, they couldn't understand the economics
right.
of land ownership. In fact, in Texas, to this day, even regular, if you cannot borrow against your homestead, mm-hmm. except for capital improvements and such.
Yeah.
You need to, because of this historic problem, not mm-hmm. just with the Indians, but with others, people losing their homestead.
Yeah.
What about the Wenatchee people? Same thing, they just kind of...
They, by the same decision that the Chelans were able to get allotments, they were able to get allotments down there.
So there's allotments along the Wenatchee River?
There were, yeah.
Those miners from California, I didn't realize how rough it was there until I read a little history about it, that it was actually a very bad extermination, probably much worse than the Trail of Tears mm-hmm. for the civilized tribes of the Southeast that went on in California, where there's a large native population.
Yeah.
But they were really, the miners, the local people, were very, very immoral people, let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
The people that came in to do the mining, they were get-rich-quick types that wanted their way right away.
They were propelled by greed.
Very much so, and within themselves.
Yeah.
Not just against each other, but against each other.
Just don't get in my way is sort of their attitude. Yeah.
Yes, it was the same type. Kind of.
Mm-hmm. That was what Chief Joseph or the Nez Perce lost mm-hmm. their home. Was around the silver mining. And
yeah.
Yeah.
And the government kept threatening banishment because, you know, if you don't move the reservation, then you'll have to go where we sent Chief Joseph, which was down here in the corner of Idaho. And Yen Mesitsa described that land as land a grizzly bear couldn't live on. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a big threat for them. Yeah.
The map that you got there, where are the reservations now?
Well, the Okanagans still have some reservation land up in here, and the Colville Reservation is still over here. I don't know if the boundaries are still the same, but there is land up there. The Yakima Reservation is down here around Yakima, so they're still here.
The Spokane Reservation.
Yeah, and the Spokanes are over. I'm not exactly sure where the Spokane Reservation is.
It's just on the other side of the Lake Roosevelt.
Okay, well,
which is, so it's... What I'm surprised is that the Colvilles kind of quietly kept their reservation, for the most part, intact. It was heavily homesteaded in the 1860s when they opened it up, late 1860s, but for the most part, they kept most of that land. And I was surprised because there was a lot of good grazing lands, timber on that country.
Well, it was, if they were able to hold on to it, it was basically by, barely by tooth and nail at times.
Yeah.
Well, they also sent everybody up there.
Yeah.
Nez Perce.
This area, sort of, the government decided this was going to be Indian country. That was sort of the decision they made, and that's why they made that deal with Moses. They decided it's worth paying this guy a bunch of money to get this problem solved. Okay, well, we have to make way for the next event. So thank you very much.